Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention? And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
This is Radio Influence. The future is now.
You're listening to Crush Performance with the Crusher, Jeff Crushell. Get in on the talent grid and text Crush at 101260 with your questions, comments, or smart-ass remarks.
All right, welcome to the show, everybody. Jeff Crushell here, the con man behind the glass. We're your weekly source for performance information. If you want to get in touch with us, our website is crushperformance.com. Email, info@crushperformance. A bunch of great emails this week. I'm really enjoying this interaction, and we do respond to every email and question we get. If you have an idea for a topic or if you have a question for the show, let us know. We may dedicate a segment or an entire episode to your idea or your topic. So get to us on Twitter. It's at Jeff Crush, and on Facebook, go to Crush Performance. Today, a really big show. I wanted to get into this because it's sort of been brought to our attention from some of our friends in the sporting models around the world, and Hockey Canada sort of leading the way and talking with Paul Carson, who's going to be joining us later in the show. He's Vice President of Membership Development for Hockey Canada. They're doing some interesting things up there when it comes to developmental sport at the developmental ages. Age-appropriate programming. And where does it fit into the sporting world? That's the topic for today. Is it good for long-term development? Do you think modifications really do influence long-term development of players and maybe push the potential ceiling higher down the road? If we look at some of the things that have been happening in the past, we've seen shorter nets, smaller rackets, smaller bats, lighter balls, smaller fields, courts, ice surfaces. There's a lot of things going on, and Hockey Canada is leading the way. But they've had some pushback. So we're going to talk to Paul Carson coming up in the next segment about Hockey Canada's thoughts on this process, exactly what they're doing, and some of the concerns they've had. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. And we're also going to look into some other sports as well. You know, a couple years ago, Connor, we talked to Hockey Canada when they supported the initiative to ban body checking up to the bantam ages. And if you remember, there was a fervor of pushback on that one, just because it gets away from maybe the traditional, I guess, developmental procedures that we've seen, developmental progressions that we've seen in the past. And I think, you know, once the dust settled, it's turned out to be okay.
Yeah, I mean, you put a little bit more of an emphasis on skill and developing those sort of things. And when it becomes, you know, the bodies develop a little bit more and you're able to do so, then you allow the body contact. I think it would, at the time, like you said, we heard a lot of people on this show texting in, you can't get rid of the body contact. It's going to ruin the game. But I mean, the way the NHL is going, it's still always going to have a part of it, but the skill is what people want to see. So it turned out to be a pretty good idea.
Well, and just think about this for a second. If it helps a young athlete focus on skills a little bit more without worried about being hitting, and plus at that age, such massive discrepancies in growth rates and size of players. So it's really not fair sometimes for a number of different reasons. But if we can reduce the risk of injuries in the developmental ages, kids are going to stay playing. There's unbelievable data showing that after the second injury, kids are dropping out. Who wants to get hurt?
Well, yeah, and the discrepancy, right? You have one kid who's might be a little bit taller and can skate a little bit better. You're probably just a bully out there. And there might be a guy who's a little bit smaller and maybe not quite where he needs to be, but he's getting run over all the time and just think, why do I want to play hockey anymore? I could play soccer or basketball where this isn't going to happen. So you're right. I think it's a good way to do it. And I mean, I'm sure if you looked at the numbers and the dropout rate, it would probably reflect it.
Yeah, for sure. You know, we're seeing, you talk about going to other sports, and we're seeing it virtually in every sport. I mean, soccer has gone to the smaller indoor type game, futsal, right, which has been a great innovation. And baseball, we're seeing the new five ball game sort of take off like wildfire. This is a great adaptation to the game. We're seeing smaller fields, smaller bats in baseball. We see rugby sevens, 3-on-3 hockey and basketball have been around forever. So we've seen these variations before, Connor. But when it comes to actual player development, what is the influence? It's really interesting. You know, we did a poll this week. I put this poll out when we were putting the show together on Twitter. And it was well-received. We had a good number of responses. And the question was, are sport modifications for kids better for long-term development? And we mentioned some examples of smaller balls, lower nets, smaller rackets, smaller ice surface sizes, and this sort of thing. We had a response that came across. 56% of our responses were, yes, it is good for long-term development. 9% said no. And 32% said sometimes. And that was an interesting one for me, because that 32% sometimes, that's a pretty big number. So my question for everybody out there today, our text line is 101260. You can get to us. What are those sometimes? When do modifications in sports make sense sometimes? For me personally, I love the half ice program for novice players, and I'm really looking forward to talking to Paul Carson. I like the modified games at the developmental level. It gives kids more success. It helps them focus on skills. It's just more tangible, Connor. And not only that, for most part, they get more playing time.
Yeah, and I mean, how many times have you watched a younger age group play hockey and the puck's just shooting away and it's just a group of them chasing?
Yeah.
And half the time they're out there for their shift, they're just chasing the puck across the ice. I mean, at least if you shrink the surface down a little bit, they're getting there quicker. The puck's on their stick, a little bit more development there. I think it's a good idea going forward. And maybe not all sports. I mean, you could probably find a way to make some exceptions to it, but I think in general, it's a pretty good way to do it.
Yeah, so we're going to be talking about that next segment with Paul Carson. So stick around for that, everybody, and let us know your opinions. When does it make sense to modify sports? And if you guys have made some modifications, listen, if you've coached or played a game and you've come across some modifications that work for you, let us know. 101260, again, the text line. We'll be getting to those texts all day. Hey, a couple things to talk about, Connor. We saw the NHL draft lottery last weekend, but I wanted to get your impressions on the kickoff for the World Hockey Championships, a blockbuster of an opening game. Canada versus U.S. Such a great rivalry.
Yeah, it really is. And I think some people might not like it because you like to see those guys meet a little bit later on when they have developed a little bit more chemistry. But I think, you know, give the people in Denmark a show, let them see a great hockey game. And it did. It's too bad it went to the shootout and Connor McDavid was unable to shoot being in the penalty box. That's the international rules. You're not allowed to participate. But I thought it was a good game for Canada. Lots they can work on. Goaltending probably being number one, but I love this tournament, and it's probably because I grew up an Oilers fan, and they were never in the playoffs when I grew up, so I was always watching the World Championship,
yeah.
Just because Ryan Smith would be going there, or, you know, one year it was Anson Carter, you could see Bill Guerin or Doug Waite go as well for the United States. It was always something to watch.
And let's face it, if your team's not in the NHL playoffs, are you really paying attention to hockey anymore? How many people really pay attention? I mean, maybe the diehard hockey fans, right? I mean, I watch here and there the highlights, but now we've got some of our players playing in the international game. I'm watching those games. I'm loving it.
I mean, I'm watching Winnipeg, Nashville.
Yeah,
it's
me too.
A heck of a series right now going on. It's must-watch TV, but you're right. I mean, you wake up in the morning, especially the time difference makes it a little bit tough. I think tomorrow we have the game on at 4:15 a.m., but the 8 o'clock game on Friday, that was definitely doable.
Yeah, for sure. And again, you know, we always look at the professional sports to sort of guide us along. And there's some great things happening, man. It was a historic day in baseball, May 4th. It was just a really, really big day. The big game in Mexico, Dodgers versus Padres, and a combined no-hitter for the Dodgers. How about that, man? I mean, a six-inning no-hitter, they pulled the pitcher. And that was a smart decision coming off of Tommy John. And there's a lot of a lashback, I guess, about that. And again, thank goodness they went on to get a no-hitter because it worked out really well for the team. But a real special day for the Dodgers and Padres in Mexico, where there's rumors that MLB might be looking for expansion.
Yeah, Walker Buehler, right? He a young player, so something you don't really want to mess up his arm. I think he had 93 pitches through the six innings,
yep.
So it's probably just safer to pull him out of there 4-0. You're right. It's great that they got the no-hitter, but that'd be something because a Mexico team, it wouldn't be too far out of the way. Be a great way to grow the game. But you're the baseball guy. Would it work?
Yeah, it would work. It really would work. I've been working in our academy down in Mexico for quite some time. There is some great, great baseball talent. Plus, they have an awesome league there already. And it could really give those players a place to go because a lot of them don't come up to the U.S. to play simply because of the minor league economics. And we've been seeing this more and more in the news. Guys are dropping out of baseball in the minor leagues because they can't afford to live. So a lot of players in Mexico, they stay in the Mexican League, summer and winter leagues especially, because they make really good money and they don't go up and play professional ball. I think this would really drive a lot of the great Mexican players towards professional Major League Baseball.
Hey, if you can grow the game without going overseas, I'm all for it. Yeah. I hear the stories of the NFL potentially going to London one day, and I just cringe thinking about it. But if you're staying in North America, same time zones, have at her.
Hey, those one-off games overseas are hard enough. There is no way you can have an NFL team in London. It can't happen. I mean, you would have to play with the clock, but just in terms of the sleep and the impact on the players,
it would have to be a full half of the season in London and then the full half in North America.
Yes.
Make it work.
Yeah, but the team's going over there. I don't know how you could do it. That's a conversation for another day, for sure. But
don't get me started. The Chargers have to go this year from the West Coast all the way to London. Come on.
Yeah. Hey, we'll talk about this for sure. We have a sleep show coming up in about 3 weeks. Disaster. It's going to be a disaster. I don't like it. Even in the one-offs, it's not going to be good. Hey, also wanted to get to this. The NBA playoffs have been fun to watch. Connor, here's my problem with the NBA. I love it. LeBron's great. The Raptors have going deep. But when it gets to the fourth quarter, halfway through the fourth quarter, I just walk away. I can't handle the timeouts. Is that unrealistic?
No, you're right. It gets to be a much. I mean, a lot of people say don't watch a basketball game till the end, you know, midway through the fourth quarter, because that's the only time it really matters. But it's true. And the fouls, it gets a little bit tiresome. I mean, if you're watching the game with your buddies, you're having a few beers. Those delays, you want to see what happens at the very end, but you got to go to the bathroom. It's a mess. I'm not for it, Crush. I wish they could accelerate that a little bit.
Yeah, me too. I would love to see it because there's such great action going on, and then it's timeout.
And
timeout.
How much
timeout.
Drama would you create without the timeout?
No, that's what I mean.
Let's not slow it down. LeBron's got to make a shot here without talking to teammates.
It would be such a fantastic change to the game if they can monitor. What do you guys think about that? Let us know. We got to cut out for a quick break. When we come back, listen, we're going to talk about modified development, age-appropriate programming for developmental sport. Paul Carson from Hockey Canada is going to join us. Let us know what you think. Is there a time and place for modifying sports? And I'm talking about smaller ice surfaces, smaller fields, modifications to equipment. Let us know. We're going to talk about it right after this on Crush Performance. Stick around.
Find out what it takes to be a top performer. Get the Crush blog, podcast, and newsletter at crushperformance.com. Now, back to the show.
And welcome back, everybody. Jeff Crochelle here, the Con Man. We're your weekly source for performance information. Thanks for hanging on over the break. A real important show today as we talk about modifications in developmental sport. Hey, if you want to get to us, our website is crushperformance.com. The Twitter handle is at Jeff Crush, and on Facebook, it's Crush Performance. All right, without further ado, let's get to our good friends at Hockey Canada. We're joined by Crush favorite, Paul Carson. Paul, thanks for hanging on over that break there.
Thanks, Jeff. It's my pleasure.
Very, very good to have you back on the show again. How have you been doing?
I've been doing well. We've had a very busy year. Olympic year is always a very busy year for Hockey Canada, but lots going on in development as well. So we're pretty excited about all of the changes we're going through and, hope to have a real positive impact on the game going forward.
Yeah, it's always exciting when we see changes. And you know what? We see the change in the Olympics. The NHL guys weren't there, which sort of changed the matrix of everything. Great tournament, regardless. We have the Hockey Champions, World Hockey Championships going on right now, a blockbuster game to kick it off of Canada versus the U.S. And of course, the NHL playoffs have been absolutely epic this year. So, Paul, I would say the game is strong globally, wouldn't you?
Top to bottom. I think that at the international level, it's really exciting to see where countries are at. At the National Hockey League level, the Canadian Women's Hockey League level, it doesn't matter which level you look at, you're seeing tremendous entertainment, tremendous competition, and then you work your way all the way down into the CHL, the CJHL, the TELUS Cup, the ESSO Cup. Everything's exciting. We're seeing so many close games, hard-fought competitions, and we're seeing some really good winners at the end of the day, but really cool events.
Yeah, Paul, I have three daughters at home, and we watch the women's game very, very closely. Canada has been just a global powerhouse forever, but I think, and my girls agree, that it's really great to see some of these other nations focusing on hockey and developing players to give Canada at least maybe a little bit of run for their money. It's great to see the women's game growing the way it is.
Well, I think it's really important to the U.S. and to Canada to see other countries really pick up the pace. I think that the Finns and the Swedes, the Swiss, the Czechs, And I think probably the real story of the Olympics in the women's game was the collaboration of North and South Korea, something that historically, I'm not sure we would have saw in our lifetime, and that was tremendous. So, yeah, I think there's really, really good things happening in the women's game, and it's really exciting to see its evolution.
Yeah, and that is such a big thing beyond sport, to see sport bringing those countries together, and who knows where that leads, but regardless, very, very, very important part of, I mean, let's just face it, our global society, there's no question, and sport is at the root of it all. We're talking with Paul Carson, the Vice President of Membership Development for Hockey Canada. Paul, isn't it interesting to see how the game changes over time? I mean, I remember being a kid and the way we went about the game and the equipment we used, of course. But this year, as you mentioned, you guys have initiated some changes that I think are really going to change the game moving forward. And there's been a little bit of pushback.
Well, a little pushback, but I think in fairness, we've done it in a progressive manner. 2 years ago, we introduced the cross-ice model with the initiation age level, so 5 and 6 year olds. And now we're introducing, and it actually becomes official in 1920, but certainly in 1819, a lot of minor hockey associations are trying to get a little ahead of the curve to half-ice hockey. And we've created what I believe to be an excellent model. And it's got different types of applications depending on the size of the association, the size of the league, the size of teams. But a 4-on-4 half ice game that engages more players in the game setting, the full ice game 5-on-5 at the novice level, which is essentially 7 and 8 year old level, has always been a bit of a top players dominate, weaker players disappear. And what we've tried to do is create a model where top players will continue to work hard and build their skill set in a smaller space, but players who are maybe not as skilled will be much more engaged in play, and they'll have an ability to develop their skills at a regular pace, much like the top players are developing.
Yeah, we asked a poll question on Twitter earlier this week when you and I were organizing this show, and I just wanted to get a feel for what people were thinking out there. So our question was, are sport modifications for kids better for long-term development? And we used the examples of smaller balls, smaller playing fields, modified equipment, and we had some interesting answers. A really good response in terms of how many people got back to us. We had 56% of the people say yes, 9% said no, and 32% we gave them the options of saying sometimes. And that's an interesting one for sure. But I think all in all, people are in favor of this. Paul, it makes so much sense. Thinking back to when I was just a little duffer playing sports, hockey, football, baseball, these smaller games, modified games, will impact the long-term development of these young athletes as they move through the sporting system.
My own experience, I was a youngster in the 60s, and I played cross-ice hockey in the 60s. We played cross-ice 3 zones. Fire hose was used to separate the 3 zones at the blue lines. And really, it was a scrimmage game. There was an opportunity to develop the, skills at the level that I thought were age-appropriate. We've gotten away from that over the last few years, last number of years, but we've watched as other sports have evolved and looked at modifications that make sense to youngsters. I'm a former physical education teacher. I spent a lot of years in an elementary school setting, and I can tell you, we were in a smaller gym. As you mentioned, we used smaller balls, smaller implements. The hoops were lower. The nets for volleyball were lower. Everything that I did when I was teaching elementary school phys ed was modified. And, I've been out of the school for 25 years, so that's how far back we go to when I was working in the school setting in a modified game setting. So I think it's important that when we look across all sports, whether it's basketball, baseball, soccer, or hockey, that, everybody is looking for ways to apply a developmental model that is age-appropriate and gives opportunities for kids to develop their skills at the right pace.
We're talking with Paul Carson, Vice President of Membership Development for Hockey Canada. Paul, you guys are no strangers to change and initiating change, all for the right reasons. We had a conversation a few years ago about the ban on body checking up to the bantam age, and there was some pushback there, but that was a really good move, I think, not just in terms of player development, but also in injury prevention as well. And I think there's some maybe injury prevention implications here when we look at smaller, maybe more age-appropriate environments for these young athletes. Listen, no young athlete wants to get hurt, and we know that second injury is critical for participation and dropout rates as well. So all these moves, I think, bode well for just keeping kids involved.
I think the body checking example that we went through a few years ago, and Jeff, you and I probably, I was on two or three times talking
yes.
about it. I think with any change, it's people that are used to a certain way of playing the game today. And if you make a change to the what they're used to, that's where the real challenge comes in. For the families that come after, so right now going to a half-ice model, I really believe that the real change, significant change, is for families today whose youngsters have just finished 1 year of novice hockey and next year may go into novice hockey playing half-ice. But the families coming after, they're not going to notice that change at all. They're going to almost think, well, this makes sense. This is the progression from going from cross ice now to half ice to, you know, potentially a larger space as they move into atom hockey. So it was the same when the full face mask was introduced a number of years ago. We introduced it early with youngsters coming into the game. We didn't apply it to bantam and midget hockey all in the same year. We let that grow organically. And you know, the same thing has happened with body checking where, you know, families whose youngsters have now grown up in a system where, you know, everybody is introduced to body checking at the bantam age level. Everybody starts at the same place.
Yeah, and there's sometimes such a size discrepancy in some of these age groups, the way the kids grow at different rates. And I think this sort of really makes a safer environment. And in terms of the smaller ice surface, I mean, just think about it, Paul. It does make so much sense. If you just step back and think for a minute, we're looking at probably more puck touches. We're looking at more chances to work and control shooting and passing. There's a heck of a lot more movement, I think, significant movement in those smaller surfaces that probably mimic the actual game of hockey more than a full ice surface for these young players. So just way more benefits here. I really, really like this.
Well, we're excited, and I work closely with a good friend and colleague, Dr. Steve Norris, who you've had on the program before, and Steve talks about all of the things that we do in society to ensure that we're not applying adult rules and adult principles to what youngsters are doing. Smaller desks in the school, smaller bicycles in the community. All of the things that you would do in terms of making modifications for youngsters based on what their needs are. The same thing has to apply in sports. And every sport goes through it. This is not just a hockey thing. We know that youngsters are using smaller golf clubs and playing on executive par threes when they're learning how to golf. We know that in every sport, it's a real challenge to find the best balance of what the game looks like and how to apply it to the age of the youngster playing.
Yeah, it's great. We're talking with Paul Carson, Vice President of Membership Development for Hockey Canada. No, Paul, such a great move. And I think, you know, these types of moves by an organization like Hockey Canada inspires other sports to maybe reconsider some of their initiatives as well. So I think, you know, this goes well beyond hockey. And you talk about Canada Sport for Life and the great people there, including Dr. Steve Norris for certain. Some really, really insightful forward-thinking initiatives as well. And one of them you and I have talked about for ages now is just the multi-sport athlete and the importance of playing other sports. I really like the idea of, you know, recreating the environment and changing the environment for sure. But playing multiple sports is almost a mandate here in Canada now.
Well, one of the things that we've been talking about in the last little while, and particularly for youngsters coming into sport at the age of, say, between 5 and 8 years old, is communities that are willing to pilot the concept of one registration fee and multiple sport experiences. There's in Antigonish, Nova Scotia, there's a group, a recreation group that's created a $300 registration fee, and the kids are exposed to something like 12 sports over the course of that 12-month period, including hockey. And what we're really trying to suggest to people is that the importance of multi-sport participation is what develops athleticism. Single sport focus at a very young age is dangerous. That's the word you have to use with parents to say that overuse injuries are scary. Early dropout, boredom, burnout, all of those things are real challenges for youngsters that start playing any sport at the age of 5, 6, or 7, and that's the only sport they play over a period of time. And I like to use the expression that development is a marathon, not a sprint. There isn't this a goal line that's in sight for a youngster to say, in order for my child to have success as a professional athlete, this is what we have to start focusing on as early as 5 and 6. We don't start studying medical books in elementary school because we want to become a doctor. We make sure that we've got that full range of academic experience, and we build up our academic skill set so that by the time we go to university, and still getting into university usually starts with a science degree before you're applying to go to medical school. So in everything that youngsters do in their developmental pathway, we need to make sure they're getting as broad an experience as possible before they start to focus. And when people say to me, at what age? I can honestly say that somewhere between 13 and 15 is the time you start to think about, you know, he's pretty good at this sport. Maybe this is what we need to do to focus on, having better opportunities for scholarships or for junior hockey or for a career in the sport.
Paul Carson, singing to the choir here. You're preaching to the choir, I'm telling you right now, and I love everything about it for sure. We're talking with Paul Carson, Vice President for Membership Development for Hockey Canada. You know, I think sometimes, you know, it's kind of maybe, Paul, an interesting conundrum, because specialization kind of makes sense in a way. That's maybe the big problem here. You dig in, go all in on a sport, you think you would come out with an advantage, but in the long game, that is absolutely not how it works. And when the studies and the research are out there now, it shows that early specialization, and when we say early specialization, I think those numbers you threw out are great, 13 to 15, but specializing before the age of 10 is a really, really dangerous venture. And it really lowers the ceiling of potential down the road for an athlete who may one day want to pursue a sport. So we have all this data now, so it's great to have these conversations.
Well, and you look at athletes, and first off, I always want to start out with a disclaimer that we don't get our children involved in sport because we think there's a professional career or a scholarship opportunity 10 to 15 years down the road. We look at sport for the holistic development of our child, and that's our purpose in getting them engaged in sport. So sometimes it's hard to use examples at the other end of the spectrum, but let's use them anyways, and let's talk about a Jordan Spieth, who's a wonderful golfer, who was a three-letter high school athlete and had an opportunity for sports scholarships in baseball and basketball. Like, these are youngsters that have played multiple sports, and even this youngster, I want to say, at University of Donaldson, the football player, he's a young quarterback who's opted into the draft this year.
Yeah.
Reading about him and his multi-sport background, baseball, basketball, football, and parents who valued his experience in all of those sports. And it shouldn't be about the ultimate prize of a professional career or a scholarship, but that pathway will certainly provide opportunities for a youngster. I just want youngsters to have a great experience in sport and allow it to be a part of their rich development as youngsters in society today.
Yeah, I know. So, so important, Paul. Excellent stuff. So let me ask you this. So the summer is upon us, and all these great changes are happening. What does the summer look like for you and Hockey Canada, Paul Carson?
Well, we look for balance for young athletes that are coming into camps in the summertime, both on the women's and the men's side. We have a lot of, our women's under 18 program and our men's under 17 program at the national level. We call them showcases. We try to create opportunities to bring those athletes together into those environments. It also gives us an opportunity to run our instructor programs and our coaching programs, because you know, once the season's over for coaches, March or April, a little bit of downtime, and then we make sure that you know, we take advantage of their availability of time for some of the coaching courses. Now, having said that, one of the exciting projects I'm working on right now is the Ivan Hlinka Hlinka Gretzky Cup in Edmonton, first week in August, I believe August 6th to 11th, and we've got an open ice summit institute. We've got coaching courses going on. We've got all kinds of things going on at Rogers Place. I've been working closely with the Oilers Entertainment Group, the Western Hockey League, Hockey Alberta, McEwen University, even Nate, doing a lot of work with a lot of people in Edmonton towards that project in August. So we're really excited about the Hlinka Gretzky Cup coming to Edmonton in August.
Great. Well, we'll talk more about that, because that is going to be a major event and some really, really important things are going to go on there. So, Paul Carson, listen, thanks so much for your time today. Just fantastic insights as usual, and we're really, really intrigued by the Hlinka Gretzky Cup coming up here. We'll talk more about that as the summer rolls along.
Awesome. I look forward to it, Jeff.
Great, Paul. Thanks so much.
Okay, take care.
All right, there you go, everybody. Paul Carson, the Vice President of Membership Development for Hockey Canada. Just a fantastic conversation. Listen, if you want to go back and get that podcast, share it with your teammates, your coaches, or your organization, go to crushperformance.com. It will be posted on Monday. Hey, stick around. Coming up after the break, how do you develop a robust, well-rounded athlete? We're going to talk about it right after this on Crush Performance.
You're listening to Crush Performance, your weekly source for sport performance and athletic development information. Get the Crush blogs, podcasts, and performance links at crushperformance.com. Now, back to the show.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. We are Crush Performance. If you have any questions, comments, or smart-ass remarks, do get to us. Crushperformance.com is the website. At Jeff Crush on Twitter and on Facebook, go to Crush Performance. Connor, a fantastic conversation with Paul Carson. I love every time we have Paul Carson and the good people from Hockey Canada on, because they're always pushing the envelope and looking for ways to make the game better. And this age-appropriate programming, I don't want to say it's breakthrough because we've seen versions of it, but to make it official and sort of, I guess, have it part of the structured developmental process is just such a smart move.
Yeah, and I mean, I just wonder, going, you know, big picture with what they do, how much of it is about developing the talents? Because we've seen in the last few years, you know, other countries are starting to catch up to Canada. And it's, you know, goaltending to the point where they're not allowing goaltenders into the WHL from outside of North America. It's gone, you know, they haven't been getting the elite goaltending at the world junior level until, you know, maybe this year with Carter Hart. It's been a while. So, I wonder big picture if it's really just trying to develop it long term, but it's helping to make the game better for these young kids. So you really can't complain.
No, not at all. And we know about the long-term development in terms of, you know, the life cycle of an athlete, and programs like the Hockey Canada program or any of the Canadian programs for sure. We're seeing it in the U.S. as well. The U.S. is really taking on some great initiatives. But the whole idea of the long-term athlete development is very, very smart. The goal, again, and Paul alluded to it, is not to produce high-performance athletes. The odds are just against it. So I don't think you go into sport with the mindset of creating a professional athlete, because if you are, that's a tall, tall order to fill. It's too much. Go in to develop great young skills. And the great thing about these models, when we look at the long-term development, is the spin-off. Good, healthy, socially responsible people. But we also will see more high-performance athletes coming out of these well-rounded, well-developed, long-term approaches as well. And I think we're seeing that in a lot of the sports in Canada.
Yeah, and yeah, it's something to watch throughout the sporting world as well. I mean, maybe some of the other sports will start to notice that it's working for the more popular sports and see what they can do to try to keep up. I would wonder, you know, in basketball, do you start lowering the rim? Do you, you know, make the court a little bit smaller?
Can you imagine if you're grade four, you're like 7 or 8 years old and you're dunking?
Yeah.
Like, how great would that be?
It would give some kids an unfair advantage. If you were the taller kids.
Yeah, no, that's a tough one. But man, would I be cool if I could dunk at like when I was 6 or 7 years of age?
It'd be the LeBron James of Tykes basketball.
It would just be Nunauer dunk fest at the school, man. lower those nets.
Who hasn't, with their friends or their own hoop, lowered it so they can dunk?
Totally.
Like, we've all done it.
Yeah.
With feel like MJ
with
for the
big
afternoon.
5-inch verticals, yeah. Just slamming it down. Love it. Yeah, no, that's funny. And that's what it's all about. Having fun, keeping kids fired up about the games, for sure. But when we talk about long-term development, let's say you get to that age where your athlete has sort of self-selected into two or three different sports. What is the secret to high-performance sport? Well, there's a lot of intangibles there. People think there's a magic bullet, you're born with it. I don't subscribe to any of that. I do believe that if you have a young athlete that has the wherewithal, the grit and perseverance, the work ethic, and the desire, let's just face it, all those things, to chase down the dream of high-performance sport, you can create opportunities. Now, whether it goes to college and beyond, that remains to be seen. We can't predict those things, but what we can do is create as much opportunity as possible, and it starts at a very young age. Listen, what we'll do here later today, follow us on Twitter at Jeff Crush. I'm going to post a little graph that was done on some professional soccer players in Denmark looking at specialization early. And it followed these kids from the age of 8, 9, 10, all the way up to the end of their careers. A really legitimate long-term look at the impact of specialization. Here's the interesting thing across the board. And it wasn't even a few of the athletes that, you know, lived beyond or played beyond the rule. It was night and day. There was a solid line that no athlete crossed. For the athletes that specialized early, they put in so many hours per week dedicated to their sport. And they get up to the level, and in the study, it goes to a national team level. So it's kind of like NCAA national team level. And that was it. Almost the entire group that they followed, who played multiple sports early on in their development, they put in as much time playing sports. But when it came to looking at the ceiling of potential, every one of the athletes in this study group that went on to play beyond their national team into professional sports were multi-sport athletes in development. And that's a really telling study. And we're seeing more and more data like this, Connor, show up in virtually every single sport. That's one example. Paul Carson, I think, said it very, very clearly in this last segment. Specializing early, parents, please listen. Coaches, please listen, is a dangerous game to play for your young athlete. And I'm talking about injuries, burnout, and dropout rates, leave alone lowering the ceiling of potential down the road.
Yeah, and I'll speak from a different level. I mean, I coach kids soccer. I've done the boys, I've done the girls. The boys, you know, the guys who play hockey, you can just see a different sort of skill set, the way they see the game. The girls that have done dance, their footwork is a lot better. So just in terms of performance, I think by not specializing, you really help out. I've coached kids that are great soccer players, but they just don't have some certain abilities that these kids who have done other sports have. So, I mean, you can talk about burnout and things like that, but just in terms of having success and being a better athlete, I think by limiting your kid to one sport, you're really not helping their potential.
There's no doubt. And they're not as coachable. There's a word we've been using with our athletes, even our pro guys. I was just down working with Baseball Canada's junior national team at the Astros and Nationals complex in Florida. The complex is fantastic. And it was great because we played the extended pro teams there. So a really, really great environment for these young athletes. But I was trying to describe to the guys, because virtually every one of those players is going to go on to a college scholarship. Every one of them will probably have some kind of a pro baseball opportunity. Just a really, really elite group. And they've gotten there in a number of different ways. But we talked about, how do you create these well-rounded athletes? And there's only one word I could come up with, Connor, to explain to the guys what I was really trying to say. And it kind of comes from the wine industry. You know, in the wine industry, they talk about robust wines, right? These really deep flavor wines. And I'm not a big wine connoisseur, though with all the work in Italy that we've done, I've really taken a liking to some red wines. I'm not going to lie to you. But when you get into and talk to the people that are so passionate about their wine, they talk about these deep flavors. But robust is a really, really powerful word to describe, you know, well-rounded, multi-layered sort of a development. And that's kind of the word I started using with the guys, and it really resonated with them. If we're going to develop robust, durable athletes, we've got to expose them to a number of things. And that takes us to another conversation here that's very, very important. How do we practice? How do we prepare for sport? You know, when I was coming up, and even in my early university years, this whole idea of perfect practice makes perfect performance, it was so wrong. At the time, we're going, okay, yeah, well, that makes sense. Let's create an environment that's so perfect where we can practice these skills in a perfect setting and we can get perfect at them. When was the last time, Connor, I have a very serious question to you and our listeners. When was the last time things were perfect? Think about it. Just think about it for a second. It's never perfect.
It's like a great saying. Ideally, that would work perfectly in sports. But hey, if you're a receiver in football, when's the last time you got a perfect pass for a whole game? Sometimes you have to adapt. Hockey, when's the last time you received a perfect pass every time? Sometimes you have to break stride. You have to reach back a little bit. It's not going to work like that in a game. So why are you practicing that way?
Yeah, no. And so what we've done in all of our training for every one of our athletes, regardless of the sport, doesn't matter if it's our golfers or squash players, and we're doing this younger and younger, creating these imperfect environments. It's this whole concept called variable or differential training. It's a very, very powerful thing. And listen, it's been around forever, since the 1800s. Bernstein is one of the first really researchers, German researcher back in the 1800s, 1900s, early 1900s, that started looking at this whole concept of variability. And his initial work was looking at blacksmiths and looking at, okay, look at these guys are swinging the hammer, and that swing of the hammer is never the same twice, and yet they always hit the same spot, creating the same outcome. And that got him thinking one day, holy smoke, so what makes a good blacksmith? And then the whole world of differential training opened up. And today it's very, very powerful. We're using it all the time. So here's a great example. All right. So with our elite hockey players, when we get them early in the summer, we do a lot of off-ice stuff, of course. And the majority of the work that we do is rebuilding the athletes from the inside out. And I'm talking about posture and range of motion from the skeleton right down to the joints and the muscles that align the skeleton right out to the periphery. But one of the things we do as an example of creating a challenging environment is we have the guys go out with their skates undone, loose, totally playing hockey and going full tilt. I'm talking about very, very controlled drills with loose skates, where these guys have to adapt and be in total control in a way they wouldn't be in a normal game. Does that make sense to you, Connor? I mean, does that give sort of maybe paint a picture of what variable training might be?
Throws them off just a little bit, but not enough where they can't play the game still.
Right, exactly. And you just mentioned something that's so important. We want to create an environment that's different enough from the actual game to build this variability, these robustness, these experiences that make the athlete better as a whole. But if we go too far away from the core purpose, then it gets meaningless. And that's where you can take an athlete backwards. So the work that you do has to be meaningful. Another great example for our hitters in baseball, and we do this at every single level, we'll get the guys to do single leg squats before they go into the cage. So we'll have them do single leg squats on their right leg. So the right leg is fatigued going into swinging the bat. And they go in, they'll do a round of 10, and they have to adapt in a way they wouldn't normally do it. But they can create outcomes. Listen to me, the body self-organizes. And the more experiences we can give our athletes in the controlled setting of training, the more things they're going to be able to do in sport. And listen to me, you can start this at the earliest ages of development. So Connor, I don't know what age your soccer players are right now, but you know, simply by changing the environment for a 10-minute period of your practice, like play the game backwards. What a great drill that would be. Because listen, here's what I can tell you right now. We do not, in every single sport, and for parents and coaches and athletes out there, run backwards at every practice and every game, because we don't spend enough time running backwards. And it can influence every single plane of movement that you compete in.
Crusher, I coach 16-year-old girls now, so I might get some feedback on that one. They might not like it a whole lot,
yeah,
but I'll throw it out there for them.
Listen, if you just incorporate backwards running into their regular warm-up, our girls, I coach my daughter's U15 soccer team. We have a 20 to half an hour period where we just move. We move and prepare them for the game, and then we get into our practice. And it's really, really been effective. And not only that, I am 100% convinced, and I don't even have to be convinced, I know for a fact it reduces their risk of injury, which is ultimately, you know, the goal. We're creating better athletes every single day. We're creating better movers. They have reduced injuries, and they're able to do more in the game, Connor. It's a win across the board. Hey, listen, we are just about out of time, so I could rant and rave about this all day long, but listen, I want to thank Paul Carson for joining us. A powerful conversation. Connor, thank you for all your time today, and I want to thank you guys for listening. Coming up next week, analytics in sport. Are the numbers accurate? Are we doing the right things? And where do we go from here? That's coming up next week, everybody. And that's it for today. Thanks for tuning in. Now, go get better, everyone, and we'll talk to you next week.
Goodbye now. Don't forget to write.
Crush Performance, we're your weekly source for performance information. Join me, Jeff Kershaw, and the Con Man as we dig deep into the science and research of talent development and skill acquisition to keep you on the cutting edge and to find out what it really takes to achieve human maximum performance. And go to our website, crushperformance.com, to get details on my brand new book, The Performance Plan, strategies for top performance in sport, business, coaching, and life. Our goal is to help you get better, and it starts with The Performance Plan. Get control, get focused, and get results. We're Crush Performance. Join us weekly right here on Radio Influence.
This is a Sitting Ringside with David Penzer. Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
I want to welcome once again Glenn Gilberti, Disco Inferno. Welcome again to Sitting Ringside.
My in-ring experience with Ric Flair was the most unique experience I've ever had in professional wrestling. I've wrestled him like three times, but he has this unbelievable skill that I wish I had. And he probably developed the skill because he had to work so many different people traveling, you know, from town to town as a world heavyweight champion over the years. I felt like I was not in control, that he was pulling me through the match the whole time. And it was just like, I felt like I was literally on like a ride. Like he was controlling everything that I did. And I've never felt that before when I've been in the ring with somebody. And I don't know how he's just very, very, very skilled at professional wrestling. And I always said Eddie Guerrero was the most talented guy I've ever been in the ring with, but the most incredible experience I ever had was wrestling Ric Flair.
Sitting Ringside with David Penzer can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.